You're listening to the Fresh Hell Podcast. Fresh Hell contains stories of a disturbing and often graphic nature and is intended for a mature audience. Please don't let your kids listen to this, or they might turn out like us. Hi, I'm Annie from the US.
And I'm Johanna from Austria, and you are listening to Fresh Hell, your favorite international podcast. If this is your first time listening to us, we are two friends who met online in a professional Candy Crush league. We never met in real life. We had planned to meet in late fall of 2020, but that never happened for obvious reasons. We will meet one day, and until then, we will at least meet in this virtual place that we created well over 2 years ago and talk all the things that involve murder, mystery, and the macabre.
Yes, and if you're a regular listener, welcome back. Thank you so much for your ongoing support. We so appreciate it, your reviews, your ratings. Thank you for sharing our content. And as always, a very special shout out to our newest Patreon members. They are Autumn Mahoney. Thank you so much, Autumn. Riley Harkey. Thank you very much, Riley. And C. Whit. Thank you, C. We are very appreciative.
Yes, thank you. We really do appreciate each and every single one of our listeners. And if you want to know more about how to support or contact us, please listen until the end of this episode. That's when we'll tell you everything about that. We love it when you send us messages with case suggestions. We just received one suggesting the Hauptmann of Köpenick, and I'm happy to inform you that this has been on my list to cover for a while already, and last week's episode reminded me of that, not because the cases are similar, just because, you know, they both involved the Prussian military in one way or another.
Yes, right. I don't know that one, so I'd like to hear it. But yeah, we absolutely love to hear your messages. One thing that we often hear is that our palate cleanser episodes are appreciated, and I love how our listeners started to call them palate cleansers, like, on their own.
True.
And it's so true. It's like, I think what they just mean is that these palate cleanser episodes that we release sometimes, they're just a bit more lighthearted and chatty. Still terrible in some way, but just a little bit more lighthearted and chatty. And sometimes we do these after really heavy topics. And as we just covered two murders in a row, well, one very brutal murder and one likely murder of a young girl, we actually wanted to do one of those palate cleanser episodes. And we not only do this for you listeners out there, but also for ourselves and our own mental health, maybe more so for ourselves, really, because y'all can just skip an episode if you don't want to hear it, but we can't. So yeah, it's not always the easiest thing to research the worst things that human beings are capable of doing to one another, like week after week. So sometimes we just need a laugh about doctors blowing smoke up their patients' asses.
Yeah, or a knight riding the devil's cock.
Exactly. And so we were trying to find a slightly lighter but interesting topic for this week's episode, maybe something funny. And then we came across this story and we decided to cover it. It's been on my list for a while. It's actually not funny. It's really very sad. And it's definitely macabre. And we hope you're as intrigued by it as we were when we read about it. Because today we're going to tell you everything about Humbug Billy and the Bradford Sweets poisoning of 1858.
Bradford is a city in the northern part of England, in the county of Yorkshire to be exact, and today approximately 540,000 people live in Bradford. In the beginning of the 19th century, Bradford was still somewhat of a rural town with a population of less than 7,000, but the town grew during the Industrial Revolution. It became somewhat well known for the fabric and wool manufacturers. So in 1844, we find that already 34,000 people lived in the once quaint little town. Bradford had a huge advantage. In the area, there were over 40 coal mines, and so the town and its factories had a constant and quick supply for the much-needed source of power. Many of the factory's workers were actually immigrants, most of them from Ireland, but, and I found that very interesting, many, many from Germany. So many, actually, that a little Germany existed or still exists in Bradford. Do you know that? Does it still exist?
I think so, yeah. Pretty sure.
What else is interesting about Bradford? So there were more than 200 factory chimneys blowing black smoke, probably containing sulfur and other very unhealthy stuff, into the air at pretty much all hours of the day. And so Bradford was one of the most heavily polluted cities in England. Some say it was the most polluted city in the whole country. And not only did those poor people of Bradford live in this polluted environment while working way too much for way too little money, they also had to endure frequent outbreaks of cholera and typhoid. Of course, the reason for that was the insufficient hygienic concept and poor water quality. And we can only imagine the stuff these factories dumped into the local water sources. Fabric manufacturing is infamous for all kinds of toxic waste, from bleach to, you know, all the stuff they need to color the textiles.
I think they actually had the largest wool factory in the world at the time. It was like...
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I think Bradford was sort of like the king of wool distributors.
I think they had a very special mix of wool with... Trying to remember what I read, it was some very high quality wool mixture.
Mm-hmm.
I have to look it up. So no wonder Bradford had the absolute lowest life expectancy in the country due to a high infant and youth mortality rate. And now it's shocking. Only 30% of the children born to textile factory workers survived past the age of 15.
Yeah.
30% survived. Due to the huge part of the population that was working in mills and factories, Bradford played an important role in the founding of unions and also in the founding of the Independent Labour Party.
It is a really beautiful area, and the Bronte sisters would one day call Bradford home. And while this area was by no means poor, as you can imagine, from all the industry that settled there over time, there was definitely plenty of wealth in the area, but the workers didn't earn nearly enough for the hard work that they were doing and the long hours, plus the bad environments that they had to endure, water shortages and unsanitary living conditions. But there was one luxury that even the poorest working class families did splurge on, and that was sugar. From an article titled, quote, "Britain is built on sugar, our national sweet tooth defines us," from The Guardian, quote, "When tea and coffee, both naturally bitter, became popular in the 18th century, sugar was their indispensable sweetener. Then, in the late 19th century, cheap jam, which was one-third fruit pulp to two-thirds sugar, began to appear on the table of every working-class household. In the 18th century, sugar was popular enough. Even the wife of the poorest farm laborer took it with her tea." The figures are astonishing. Britain's annual per capita consumption of sugar was 4 pounds in 1704, 18 pounds in 1800, and 90 pounds in 1901, a 22-fold increase to the point where Britain's had the highest sugar intake in Europe. End quote.
That's a lot of sugar.
That's a lot of sugar. I like sugar.
I like the history of sugar because it's super interesting. I mean, who are we kidding? I find most things kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But let's talk about sugar just a little bit. So back in the days before Alexander the Great, people in Europe used honey for sweetening, if they even sweetened their food and drinks at all.
It was a savory time, the olden days. I think I would have wanted to live post-sugar, I feel like.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Sugar and salt is... But salt is more important for me. I don't like it too sweet, but yeah. Mm. So that's because sugarcane was not known outside of the Asian continent. Sugarcane mostly grew on the Indian subcontinent and people would chew on it to get a taste of the sweet. Soon enough, people in India discovered a way to crystallize the sugarcane juice and thus make it easier to store and transport and ultimately trade. But still, sugarcane was far from being a widespread plant, but it slowly made its way from India to Afghanistan and on to Persia and finally to the Arabian Peninsula. Alexander the Great, on his war campaign in India, was introduced to sugarcane, and he and his troops brought it back to ancient Greece, where it was mainly used for medicine. It was so rare and expensive that it was not thought to be a normal everyday sweetener. They actually thought that sugarcane has some healing properties and was beneficial for your health. And then a couple of centuries later, the crusaders brought bags of what they described as sweet salt when they returned from the Holy Land. And then the Venetians saw a huge business opportunity and started not only trading sugar, but what they did is they actually bought land in what nowadays is Lebanon. And there they would grow their own sugarcane. And a while later, sugarcane was brought to Madeira and the Canary Islands. And now all of a sudden, sugar was much more available in Europe, although still extremely precious, and a treat for the rich. Now, candied fruits, pastry, and candy was eaten at court all over Europe. And legend has it that Queen Elizabeth's teeth were completely rotten because of her love for sugar. And of course, because of poor dental hygiene. And at the French court, it became fashionable to blacken your teeth to make them look as if they were eaten away by cavities. Only the most wealthy people could afford to have their teeth destroyed by sugar. And then, of course, sugar cane was brought to Hispaniola by Christopher Columbus and his men. From there, it spread to South America. And due to slavery, it was now even cheaper to produce sugar. And then something happened. In 1747, two Germans found a way to extract sugar in beets. Now, sugar was more easily available in Europe without having to rely on the goods from Madeira and Hispaniola. And that invention came just in time for Napoleon and the Continental Blockade, which basically meant a trading embargo for Great Britain, and that now British ships could not land in most European ports any longer. Napoleon soon had to realize that this didn't really harm the British economy, because they still kept trading with Spain and Russia, and therefore this is one of the reasons for his Russian campaign. Of course, this is all an oversimplification of many multi-layered events in history. So, British ships not being able to land on mainland Europe, sugar from Madeira and so on would not find its way into European stores, and so Napoleon was ultimately the one who was responsible for having sugar beet planted and processed on a large scale. And this is a very brief history of sugar, and basically only up to the point when our story takes place mid-1800s. But I told you, it's quite fascinating. Thank you to the three listeners who are still here by now.
I'm sure we have at least three listeners that are still with us. I do find the history of sugar to be really interesting, especially since I'm such a fan of it. And even though sugar was less expensive than in all those centuries before, in 1858, it was definitely still a luxury good. As we heard before, British people loved their sugar, even though they had to be very frugal, but they did often treat themselves with jam, pastry, or candy. And one of the places in Bradford where people could go to purchase sweet treats was at the Green Market in the city center. And in one of the stalls there at the Green Market was a man named William Hardacre, and he sold candy. He was known to the good people of Bradford by his nickname, which was Humbug Billy.
I need to interfere here for a second.
Please interfere.
I want to say that in German, we do have the word Humbug, but it's Humbug, but only in the Bah Humbug sense of the word. So when I read the name Humbug Billy, I thought he was a kind of shady person, a bit of a con man maybe even charming in a P.T. Barnum kind of way. But that was not why William was called Humbug Billy.
No, it was not. So it's the same here. We also do not have a candy that we call the humbug. There's just, I think most Americans would not know what a humbug was.
So I looked at pictures. I mean, we do have those that look similar. They kind of look like they're called Seidenzuckerl, but I have to say, Zuckerl is the Austrian word for candy, and it comes from the German word for sugar, which is Zucker. And in Austria, we love to put "-n-" at everything to make it more tiny and cutesy. So yeah, they look like Seidenzuckerl, but Seidenzuckerl are always filled with something like cream or chocolate or things
right.
like that.
Oh, it's like a surprise filling in a hard candy. Mm.
Yeah.
I like those, I think everybody knows those candies. They're not humbug. They're those, do you get them in Austria as well? They're, I don't even know what they're called. They're strawberry candy, and they're in like a strawberry looking wrapper, and they have like a strawberry gel in the middle. It's like the only like filled hard candy that I like, I think. I'm not really a fan of a liquid center. Like, it always surprises me, but not in a great way. And I do think humbugs can be filled. We don't, like I said, we don't really use the term either. When I looked at a picture of it, I think Americans, if I said to you, it's sort of a hard candy in the shape of a root beer barrel, but striped candy usually. It's just a hard candy. In the UK, they would say it's a boiled sweet, but that's also something that it's a term we don't use here, just hard candy.
Yeah, I think it's all very similar, I guess.
Yeah, just an early old-timey hard candy. And yeah, humbug can mean deceptive, false talk behavior, or in the British, a boiled sweet, especially one flavored with peppermint. And that's what Humbug Billy was famous for, the candy known as the humbug. From my favorite source, Wikipedia. Let me see if I can put on the monotone that people hate. No, I'm just kidding. I'm not going to do that. I do try to use a slightly different voice when I'm reading a quote, just so it's clear that I'm reading a quote and not using my own words. Anyhow, okay, this is a quote from Wikipedia. Quote, Humbugs are a traditional hard-boiled sweet available in the United Kingdom, Ireland, South Africa, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. People are going to start sending us humbugs now. They are usually flavored with peppermint and striped in two different colors, often black and white. In Australia, the black and white striped humbugs are flavored aniseed and sold at all major supermarkets. Records of humbug exist from as early as the 1820s. The name of the sweet is not related to the phrase "bah humbug" from Charles Dickens's novel, A Christmas Carol. That expression implies a general dissatisfaction with the Christmas season, connected to the use of humbug as a joke, or especially a fake. However, offering humbugs around Christmas time is now seen by some as humorous or ironic, end quote. So, that's fun. Merry Christmas! Want a humbug? Now I really want some humbugs. All right, can you tell I'm on my liquid diet phase? So, Humbug Billy sold humbugs, but he did not produce the candy himself. He had a supplier who was named Joseph Neal, and he had his business on Stone Street, not far from the Green Market. And there, he would produce his candy, and the recipe was easy enough. He would begin by rolling out a dough made out of sugar with natural gum and infused with peppermint oil. I don't think that his humbugs had any kind of surprise liquid filling, which is great. And as we said before, sugar was still very expensive. 1 pound of sugar would cost the equivalent of 50 British pounds in today's money. So that's 68 US dollars or 58 euros for a pound of sugar. What's the price for sugar now in Austria? Do you know? I have no idea how much sugar costs now.
Well, we have kilograms. So I'd say 1 kilogram of sugar is definitely less than a euro, and 1 kilo is a bit more than 2 pounds, so a pound roughly 50 euro cent.
Yeah.
But that's Austrian sugar from beet, right?
Right. I think ours is around that way. It's not expensive sugar. It's affordable.
Yeah. Let me just make sure the price of sugar made from sugar cane, what is that right now? So I can purchase 1 pound of organic sugar from sugar cane for roughly 1.50 euro. So that's very far from 58 euros.
Oh yeah, that's a big difference. It was really, really expensive back then. And even more so in the UK, they hadn't really started to look into using beetroot for sugar. Sugar was still mostly coming from the West Indies. And then, of course, the abolition of slavery had caused the price to rise again. Also, it was still taxed as a luxury item. And so people who had to work with sugar came up with little tricks in order to get more out of it. Sort of like today's modern drug dealers, right? So they would cut their sugar with something called daft.
I mean, it sounds intriguing, but I know it isn't as fancy as one might think it is.
It almost never is, right?
So
true. What they called daft, it's all, you're like, ooh, what's that? Nope, not interesting. And what they called daft, it was basically plaster of Paris or limestone or terra alba, which is white earth, which I'm not entirely sure what that is, but yeah. Well, they called it daft because if you would tell people that you made their expensive treats with plaster of Paris, they probably would have been less enthusiastic about it, right? But sometimes they also called it daff, multum, flash, or stuff.
Okay, but the ones who called it stuff, they didn't even try.
Right? Not even a little bit. They're like, listen, it's sugar and peppermint and some other stuff. It's fine. Just eat it. This is something, I think it's still safe to say this happens all the time, but it just happens with street drugs instead of sugar these days.
I mean,
and it's not always with inert ingredients that won't hurt you, so be careful, please.
In Vienna, we have the drug box. It's called the jacket box, and there you can anonymously throw in a little probe of the street drug you just bought, and then like 2 days later or so you can go check, and then in the shop window they will have the analytics of what is inside your drug. On the one hand, I think it's good and safe for people, but who also waits for 2 days until they consume the drugs that they just bought, right?
Well, I mean, yeah, I don't know. I guess it depends on what the drug is. I know I read something a while ago that Amsterdam had something where you could check to see if there was actually MDMA in the ecstasy that you were sold. I don't even think they call it ecstasy anymore. What do the kids call it today? Molly? I'm not up on the new drug lingo. I'm such an old lady now. But I think it's smart to be able to know what's in there. As you said, who's going to check. Who's going to wait? That's, I guess, but at least having the option is nice. Yeah. And so ingesting plaster or limestone, it's not tasty, but it's not dangerous. It's not going to hurt you.
Mm.
So James Neal prided himself with using the best and most exclusive daft. According to sources, it was a mix of several ingredients. One of them was the finest Derbyshire spar. James did, of course, not make the daft himself. He purchased it from his trusted source, a pharmacist by the name of Charles Hodgson. His pharmacy was in Shipley, which was a town 3 miles, or 4.8 kilometers, north of Bradford. So whenever needed, James Neal would make his way to Shipley and purchase his daft there. He knew he could trust Hodgson, that only the best of the best would be in his daft. And everything was fine. Until it wasn't. Because one day, in October of 1858, John realized that he was out of daft. He needed to get some from his source in Shipley, but for one reason or another, he couldn't go himself, and so he sent a man named James Archer to go and get the daft for him. Archer was John Neal's lodger, and so we can assume that he didn't know a lot about the candy-making business. So Archer makes his way to Shipley. He walks into the pharmacy of a Mr. Hodgson and probably says something like, "Good day, Mr. Neal sent me for more of the daft." But that day, it wasn't Mr. Hodgson behind the counter of the pharmacy. It was Hodgson's young apprentice, a man by the name of William Goddard. Charles Hodgson was not feeling well that day and decided to rest and leave young William in charge. And you know how back then almost all shops and little businesses were in houses of the business owners? What I mean is the store would be in front, and then in the back or upstairs would be the living quarters. Which is very practical, yeah. I think we agree, right?
Yeah.
And I'm sure William Goddard found it practical as well, because when James Archer walked in and asked for daft, he had no idea what he was talking about. So he excused himself for a moment and went to the back to ask his boss about the daft and where he would find it. Hodgson tells his young assistant what it is and that he can find it in the corner of the attic storage. So Goddard climbs up to the attic, walks to the wrong corner, and doesn't pack 12 pounds of daft. Instead, he packs up 12 pounds of arsenic trioxide, which was not labeled properly.
Yeah, that's not good. That's not what you want in your candy, in your Zuckerl. So we talked about arsenic quite a bit already, mostly in our Victorian death trap episode.
Oh yeah.
And while it's sometimes used in modern healthcare, primarily with some forms of leukemia, when our story takes place, it's poison. And here is a very quick reminder of what it is from Annie's favorite source for basic descriptions, Wikipedia. Quote, arsenic trioxide is an industrial chemical used in the manufacture of wood preservatives, pesticides, and glass. As a medication, it is used to treat a type of leukemia. Arsenic trioxide is readily absorbed by the digestive system. Toxic effects are also well known upon inhalation or upon skin contact. The first symptoms of acute arsenic poisoning by ingestion are digestive problems. Vomiting, abdominal pains, diarrhea, often accompanied by bleeding. Sublethal doses can lead to convulsions, cardiovascular problems, inflammation of the liver and kidneys, and abnormalities in the coagulation of the blood. These are followed by the appearance of characteristic white lines on the nails and by hair loss. Lower doses lead to liver and kidney problems and to changes in the pigmentation of the skin. Even dilute solutions of arsenic trioxide are dangerous on contact with the eyes. End quote. And we talked about the different uses of arsenic, for example, in beauty routines. They did cure acne, for example, or the use in certain type of paint, which would bring us right back to Napoleon again. And let's not forget my favorite fact about arsenic, that it was also kind of the Styrian cocaine used by Styrian farmers as an upper so that they could get through their long and hard work days.
Yeah, in Victorian times, arsenic was used for so many things, including my favorite color of green, but you definitely wouldn't want it in your candy. And yet, here we are. So Archer takes the package of what he thinks is daft, but which is in fact a giant pile of poison, back to James Neal, and neither Neal nor his employee, a man named James Appleton, realize that this was not their usual daft. How that happens, I don't know, but there were a lot of things that went wrong for this all to happen the way it did. So both men, Neal and Appleton, were experienced candy makers, but again, they somehow didn't catch this enormous mistake. However, once they were done making their newest batch of humbugs, they did think that these looked a little bit different from their usual humbugs. And also, while making the candy, Appleton had started to feel very sick and had started vomiting with terrible pain in his extremities. He only recovered several days later. How this wasn't an immediate red flag, I mean... But then, of course, it could have just been iffy fish, right? I mean,
yeah,
there were
true.
So many things back then that could cause terrible vomiting and pain that weren't poison. It was a hard time. Or if you're like me and you've just got a bunch of weird medical conditions and you're playing my favorite game, what's causing these symptoms? But yeah, he was really, really sick for several days, and that was also somehow not a red flag. So now Humbug Billy comes over because he's out of candy and needs more for the shop, and he looks at the humbugs and tells Neil that they look weird. He doesn't like the way they look. They don't look quite like the humbugs he usually gets from him. But he tries one and decides they taste all right. But still, Humbug Billy insists on getting a discount because these are kind of weird looking. And so he purchases 40 pounds or 18 kilograms of these slightly shady looking candy.
Now, people who are way better at math than me did some calculations and they figured that each humbug must have contained between 0.6 and 1 gram, so that's 0.02 to 0.03 ounces of arsenic trioxide. That's more than twice of the lethal dose per piece of candy. And so the 40 pounds humbug Billy purchased, they would have been enough to kill 2,000 people. And that's 10 times the population of the village where I am living right now.
The whole idea of this is pretty daft. So today, daft usually means like crazy or insane or silly. But there's nothing silly about this much arsenic. It's too much arsenic. It's just too much. I'm sorry. But I'm sorry. It's just too much. It's too much arsenic, though. So Humbug Billy takes his 40 pounds of homemade candy and he returns to his stall at the green market where he promptly starts to sell the new batch, but he also starts to feel really sick. This is when things get terrible. Okay. The next day, two young boys, ages 9 and 14, die. But at first, it's believed that they died from cholera because, if you remember, infant and youth mortality was still incredibly high. But over the next 2 days, more and more people start to feel really poorly, and they're getting sick and they're dying. And finally, authorities are alerted to this situation, and they know something is really wrong. And soon enough, they can trace everything back to Humbug Billy and his stall at the green market. Once they figure out what has happened, they immediately confiscate the deadly candy, but it's too late. William Hardacker had been selling humbugs for over 2 days, and more than 200 people were poisoned by the sweet candies. 21 people died because they had a craving for something sweet that day. This is an article from the Salisbury and Winchester Journal from the 6th of November, 1858. Quote, "The poisonings by arsenic at Bradford. Yesterday, the magisterial inquiry into the extensive poisonings by peppermint lozenges, in the making of which arsenic had been used mistaken for plaster of Paris, was resumed at the Bradford courthouse. The particular death which was the subject of the inquiry was that of Elizabeth May Midgley, a child 7 years of age, who died on Wednesday morning at the house of her parents, working people living in Bradford. The grandmother of the deceased bought 2 ounces of peppermint lozenges on Saturday night at the stall of William Hardacker in the Bradford Green Market, and 2 of the lozenges were given to the deceased on Sunday afternoon. Immediately afterwards, she became ill and died, as already stated. Other members of the same family were poisoned by eating of the lozenges, but they have recovered. Mr. Henry Taylor, surgeon of Bradford, who had attended the deceased, proved that she had died from the effects of some irritant poison. Mr. F. W. Remington, analytical chemist, who had made analysis of some of the lozenges sold to the deceased's grandmother, and also of lozenges found on the Hardacre stall, stated that each lozenge weighed about 43 grains, and the average quantity of arsenic contained in each was about 14 grains. Mr. Remington also proved the presence of arsenic in the deceased's stomach and intestines, which were given to him to analyze by Mr. Taylor, who made the post-mortem surgical examination. The mayor, after the new evidence had been heard, said the bench were of the opinion that the 3 persons in custody, namely Charles Hodgson, druggist of Shipley, at whose shop the arsenic was supplied, William Goddard, his assistant, and Joseph Neal, confectioner of Stone Street, Bradford, the manufacturer of the lozenges, must be committed for trial at the next Yorkshire Assizes for manslaughter. The number of deaths which have occurred from having partaken of the poisoned lozenges is 17, and there have been cases of illness reported from the same cause, but these are not by any means the whole number of persons that have suffered by partaking of the lozenges, 51 pounds of which, at least, are known to have been sold. A public subscription has been opened in Bradford for the purpose of aiding the surviving sufferers. Most of them are among the working classes." End quote. Basically, what this article is saying is that although people were brought before the bench. They were released on their own recognizance, having paid some modest fines. And they're letting people know that at this point, there have been 17 deaths and still a lot of people are sick. So, the doctor who first realized that these deaths were caused by arsenic poisoning was a man by the name of John Bell. And actually, that's the same name as my late husband's dad. I call him Dad Number Two, and he's from that part of the country. So now I'm wondering if there's some connection there. But in any case, Dr. Bell was the one to make the arsenic connection, and the chemist, Mr. Remington, who is mentioned in this article, he verified John Bell's suspicion.
It's very sad, and it's actually a very scary thought.
Oh, yeah.
That this can happen. So as the newspaper article stated, initially the charge was to be manslaughter, but all charges were dropped eventually when investigators figured out the chain of events that led to the death of 21 people. And while tragic, it was an accident and there were no laws that they had broken. Nowadays, having toxic substances in unlabeled containers would get you in a lot of trouble and you definitely would be charged if someone would be harmed because of your negligence. But we know how this works. So many times horrible things have to happen for people even to realize that this is a problem and that people could be injured or worse.
Definitely, yeah.
But still, people were outraged by the death of so many people, and of course, so many of them were children, because yes, you buy sweets and you give them to your children, right?
Of course. I feel so badly for that grandmother. Can you imagine giving your grandchild a couple of peppermint candies?
Yeah, horrible.
Awful.
So something needed to be done. And in 1860, the Adulteration of Food and Drink Bill was set in place, and this bill now regulated how and with what consumable goods could be mixed. And in 1868, the UK Pharmacy Act was introduced, regulating the selling and handling of toxic and non-toxic substances by pharmacies. Kind of funny though, how we started out to doing a palate cleanser episode and ended up talking about deathly sweet treats.
I know. It does seem daft that no charges were filed. Sorry, I'm just going to keep using that term in weird ways. But I mean, I guess they just didn't have laws for negligence back then, right? I will say I feel like this episode is a palate cleanser only in the sense that there was no malice. Do you know what I mean? It was just, I mean, it's horrific that it happened, but it was all just a terrible, terrible mistake. Unless the apprentice who went into the attic was a sociopath who just wanted to see what happened if he killed a bunch of people. But I really don't think that was the case. I think it was just a really, really terrible accident.
And what I was thinking about when I read this story, and then I told my husband about it, and that's the same thing he said. He said, well, isn't that what happened in It's a Wonderful Life with George Bailey in the pharmacy? And yeah. It's true.
Oh, I don't know. I've never seen it.
Moving on. Do you have something good, Annie? It's a Wonderful Life is a US classic movie. Me,
oh, I know.
Being from Austria, having seen this movie probably 15 times. You being from the United States, never having seen Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life.
It's almost become like a thing now. We've never seen It's a Wonderful Life, and we've never seen Miracle on 34th Street? I keep wanting to say 42nd Street, yeah, but I think that's a musical. Miracle on 34th Street. We've never seen either of those movies, and maybe we'll wait till you visit and watch them. it's just one of those things. We keep meaning to watch them, and then we haven't. So one of these days, well... we'll have seen them. But now it's become a thing. Like, all of our friends tease us because they know we've never seen them. And now I feel like we just shouldn't. Like,
yeah, don't. Just don't. Just,
I mean.
It's gonna be your thing.
It's fine. So, something good. What's good? You know what's good? The Olympics are on. I'm a fan of the Olympics. It's funny because I was talking to my dad and Moose were here over the weekend. And we were all kind of talking about sports and my parents tried so hard to get us into different sports and into playing sports. And my sister was more into it than I was, but I've never been into a sport. I don't know if you were ever. Did you play any sports in like...
No,
high school. I hated or it. Yeah.
We had to always play in PE. We had to play volleyball, and I had long nails. And my PE teacher always told me I have to cut my nails because I'm never going to be able to play volleyball properly. And I always told her, I don't mind. I don't want to play volleyball properly. I want to have nice nails.
Yeah. But that's funny because my dad asked me about volleyball, and I was like, well, I used to get a rash. You know how you have to like make a fist and then hit with your forearms? Yeah. Where you hit the ball, I would get like a rash from hitting the ball. Like, repeatedly, I'd get like hives. It was weird.
I have to say, nowadays, looking back, I wish I would have been more into sports because I just started to be into some kinds of sports well into my 30s, and it was so much harder for me to start than it is
right
when you're a teenager or even a child.
Yeah. We used to ski, our parents, because where we grew up, skiing was really easy and nearby and not that expensive. There was Mount Tom and Blandford were both close before, like, ski slopes. So we used to ski, and we swam all summer because we, you know, I grew up on the water, and our parents made us take swimming lessons and get certified as lifeguards, but we never, that was sort of it. And then we also had to play sports in gym class and PE. And I was saying to my dad how I'm not competitive, I think is the problem. I'm not a competitive person. If I have a ball and you're running at me because you want the ball, just fucking take the ball. I don't want it. Like, I don't care about any of this. Just have it. You clearly care more about this than I do. I'm not looking to get tackled or knocked over or I don't want to take the ball from you. You look like you really want it. I'm not going to take it from you. There's a reason I was always picked last in gym class. I could not care less about sports if I was dead. It's great if you're into it and it's your thing. It's just, it's not my thing. But I love watching other people who are passionate about the sports that they play. And so I love the Olympics. That was my whole point. I'm so excited. And the Austrian woman who just won the gold in cycling, that was a great race to watch.
Did you know that she's actually not a professional cyclist? She's a mathematician. That's her job. And she just swooshed in front of all of them.
Yeah, and I heard that the leader of the peloton just didn't see it. So she didn't know there was anybody she was supposed to be chasing. So yeah, that's why she was, it was amazing. It was like, what a once in a lifetime situation. Yeah. I'm so happy for her. But the other thing that I feel really strongly about, and now that I have a platform with like at least 3 people who listen, I just wanted to put it out there because maybe we can make this a thing that happens. My favorite thing is when somebody gets a personal best at the Olympics. It's great to win gold. Like, don't get me wrong. Obviously, that's everyone's goal, right? But most people won't. And I think it's so much more meaningful and impressive if you actually get a personal best at the Olympics. I think that's amazing. And I wish there was some kind of small, like, medallion, like a very small pendant. Like, it doesn't have to be gold, silver, or bronze. Like, it could be pewter or tin. I don't know. But just, like, it would be nice if you got some small engraved necklace thing you could wear, just marking the fact that you had actually achieved a personal best at the Olympic Games. Because that's, I think, like, I don't know. It's more moving for me in a way than people who have won 10 gold medals. It's like, yeah, obviously, you're amazing. You're the best at what you do. You're the GOAT. You're the best. It's fantastic. But like, to get a personal best at the Olympics, that's something. I don't know. I love the Olympics.
My something good is also something that kind of extremely stresses me out at the moment. So a bird has decided to build a nest right next to my entrance door. And it had built a nest like 2 months ago. It's a tiny bird. I don't know the English name of it now. It's a Rotschwänzchen in German. Tiny, tiny, tiny. And the bird was there for 2 months and nothing ever happened. But now 2 little heads are peeking out of the nest.
Aww.
And so constantly now I'm worried that something happens to the baby birds. I'm kind of obsessed. Like, we have a lot of storm and thunderstorms and rains going on in the last couple of nights, like horrible. And so every couple of hours I sneak outside from far away to check if they're okay. And of course they are, because they are birds, they know what they're doing. But yeah, it kind of stresses me out. I have this whole maybe some of your listeners remember when I found the hedgehog and I tried to save it because it was winter and he was way too weak and I took him to the vet and he didn't make it. And this whole kind of experience, I think after my dad died, has given me this kind of traumatic reaction to anything that is dead. And so it's lovely. I love that the birds are there, but it's kind of stressful for me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Can you understand?
We do. I do. We had robins that built on our side porch. We don't use our front door. It's really, really, really old and takes about 45 minutes to open properly. So we rarely open the front door. We use the sort of side door, the back door of the house. And the side door has a little porch with wisteria that sort of grows up the side and across, and we had robins make a nest in the wisteria. So we've been using the back door, and just the mail lady comes, and they're all right with her. She's awesome. Yeah, it's I get so excited every time I see a nest with babies in it, but I'm the same with you. I check obsessively. Oh, you know what else is really funny that I keep forgetting to tell you? Opus is afraid of rabbits. We have a lot of rabbits. We have a very healthy rabbit population, both here and on the Cape, and they are not afraid of people, really. They're just not. They're fine. And so usually he'll go out and just, if he sees one out there, he just keeps his eyes on it while he pees or whatever. Sometimes he'll try to chase one a little bit, like to play. But then the other day he was chasing one and it just stopped running and turned around and like squared off with him. And he was like, oh shit. And he like sat down, and my 120 pound dog sat down and just started barking because the rabbit, the bunny, was just staring him down and holding his ground. So we had to go out and shoo the bunny away because he was afraid of it. So yeah, Opus is afraid of bunnies. That's fun. I'm hoping it means we won't get any squished bunnies, because there's already a cat in the neighborhood that kills them and leaves their carcasses around the yard. So I don't want Opus to also be a bunny biter. I want him to be a friend to rabbits, and it seems to be working out. He's afraid of them. So mission accomplished. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate everything that you do. We really appreciate your reviews. If you'd like to help us out with the show, one thing that you can do is go to podcastawards.com and vote for our show. We are absolute underdogs. There is very little chance that we will win, but we would love your vote. And so if you go to podcastawards.com, you will find us in True Crime, Female Hosted, and People's Choice. So we would so, so appreciate that. What else? You can join our Facebook group, which is full of the most lovely people. Search for Fresh Hell Murder and you'll find them. Also there you'll find albums that have photographs from all the cases we discuss, as well as our sources. You can also visit our webpage, which is freshhellpodcast.com, which will have links to everything. Is that everything? Am I forgetting anything?
Tell your pets we said hi.
Tell them we love them.
Hug them, hold them.
Yep.
Be always kind to them.
Yep. Be kind to everyone. Yeah. Just try.
We love them. We miss them.
Yeah. We miss you. We hope to see you soon. And until next week, if you're going through hell,
keep going. Tschüss.
Bye.